We think all of you know that the schedule for our work is in the periodical. We are, of course, in February at this point, and our Sunday meetings are a little different for February and March. They are panel discussions, all in comparative religions. And for today, our subject has to do with spiritual growth and its search, learn, and apply knowledge. Next Sunday, again, spiritual growth, the power of faith and devotion. Of course, we meet on Wednesday evenings as well from 7:45 to 9 for our study class, where we're in the middle of a study in the Ocean of Theosophy on the subject of reincarnation. The reference library is open previous to that meeting from 5:30 to 7:30. The books are for sale on the book table before and after meetings and during the library hours. The work at this lodge, as at every United Lodge of Theosophists, wherever in the world it is situated, is done on the basis of independent devotion and on the basis of voluntary donations of time, of service, and of money. And of course, it does take money to keep the building open. But any donation received is used only for the purpose of being open for public meetings. There are no salaries, no officers, no dues, no fees. It is all on the basis of the policy on the back of the declaration. And it's definitely worth your study and consideration. We think you will find it the most succinct, truly democratic declaration of a method for working together on a basis that most people would say couldn't possibly work. It requires cooperation and fierce effort by those who would agree with it. But the United Lodge has been in operation since 1909, and here in this city since 1925. So obviously, it does work. Of course, everyone is invited to all of the meetings, and as we said, there are no dues, no fees. We do not pass the hat. Now, in going to our subject of search, learn, and apply knowledge, when we come to the comparative religion side of this question, every religion points to the importance of knowledge and the need for the soul to use that knowledge to turn it into wisdom. So, let's just look at a few quotes from each of the major ideas. Islam: the search for knowledge is an obligation laid on every Muslim. There is no greater wealth than wisdom, no greater poverty than ignorance. Hinduism: knowledge is the holiest of holies, the god of the gods. The fixtures and furnitures of one's house may be stolen by thieves, but knowledge, the highest treasure, is above all stealing. One not knowing a land asks of one who knows it. He goes forward instructed by the knowing one. Such indeed is the blessing of instruction. One finds a path that leads him straight onward. Judaism: the biblical tales are only the Torah's outer garments. Woe to him who regards these as being the Torah itself. Let your house be a place of meeting for the wise. dust yourself with the dust of their feet and drink their words with thirst. Sikhism. True learning induces in the mind service of mankind. Realization of truth is higher than all else, but higher still is truthful living. Buddhism. And of course, there are many more from Buddhism, Christianity, and Hinduism than anyone else, and most of them we are all familiar with. But sometimes being familiar with something means we stop seeing it, hearing it, using it, recognizing it. Buddhism. Though he recites many a scriptural text, but does not act accordingly, that heedless man is like a cowherd who counts others' cattle. Do not believe in anything simply because you have heard it. Do not believe in anything simply because it is spoken and rumored by many. Do not believe in anything simply because it is found written in your religious books. Do not believe in anything merely on the authority of your teachers and elders. Do not believe in traditions because they have been handed down for many generations. But after observation and analysis, when you find that anything agrees with reason and is conducive to the good and benefit of one and all, then accept it and live up to it. All that we are is the result of what we have thought. The mind is everything. What we think, we become. Christianity. Stand in the assembly of the elders. Who is wise, cleave to him. Be ready to listen to every narrative, and do not let wise proverbs escape you. If you see an intelligent man, visit him early. Let your foot wear out his doorstep. By wisdom, a house is built, and through understanding, it is established. Through knowledge, its rooms are filled with rare and beautiful treasures. Choose my instruction instead of silver, knowledge rather than choice gold. For wisdom is more precious than rubies, and nothing you desire can compare with her. Confucianism. The master said, "Only one who bursts with eagerness do I instruct. Only one who bubbles with excitement do I enlighten. If I hold up one corner and a man cannot come back to me with the other three, I do not continue the lesson." The superior man acquaints himself with many sayings of antiquity and many deeds of the past in order to strengthen his character. From different African traditional religions. Without proverbs, the language would be but a skeleton without flesh, a body without soul. Wisdom does not come overnight. Knowledge without wisdom is like water in the sand. Taoism. The Taoist priest looked around the middle hall and said, "You have a rare gem in your house, for when I entered, I saw the radiance of a holy light. Where do you keep your treasure?" The homeowner answered, "In this poor dwelling, there is nothing worthy of the name treasure." The priest then took him by the hand and led him to the place where the treatise on response and retribution lay, saying, "This holy book is the treasure. If a man disciplines himself according to its instructions, the truth will shine forth in all its glory, and every letter in the sacred writing will emit rays of divine light. Wisdom is to be treasured. And concluding with a few more Hinduism that will be familiar to all of us. Even if thou wert the greatest of all sinners, thou shalt be able to cross over all sins in the bark of spiritual knowledge. As the natural fire, O Arjuna, reduceth fuel to ashes, so does the fire of knowledge reduce all actions to ashes. There is no purifier in this world to be compared to spiritual knowledge. And he who is perfected in devotion findeth spiritual knowledge springing up spontaneously in himself in the progress of time. Seek this wisdom by doing service, by strong search, by questions, and by humility. The wise who see the truth will communicate it unto thee, and knowing which, thou shalt never again fall into error. So this is what we find. And of course, if you go about a search of your own, which you should, you will find many other quotes and statements, proverbs, sayings, in various religions and philosophies. Everywhere we look, in any level of life, we are encouraged to learn, to go after knowledge, and then to use and apply it. But certainly, for students of theosophy, the entire premise from independent devotion on is one of study and application. So we'll hear about the theosophical ideas.
We believe everyone in this room has been searching for the three other corners of the complete knowledge. Was it Confucius? We believe. It was said, one corner will be given, and if the student can't find the other three, then the teaching would cease, because search is the first step. Everyone who is in this room has been searching and seeking, and what they have understood so far has not been sufficient. So the search is always the first step, and theosophy tells us it is done independently. That may seem so on the outside, but we are never without a friend. We are never without an elder, a more perfected soul, helping where possible to guide us in the right direction. We are promised that man is never without a friend. So we begin this search, and we have found ourselves here today. So Patanjali offers the thought that the desire for knowledge is always pure. If we are truly seeking out that which is eternal, the truth which is eternal, that search is a pure one. And he also said the highest motive is impossible without the highest knowledge. So if our idea of application is to be and apply this knowledge the very best that we can, at any time, the highest motive would seem to be a key essential ingredient in our learning. And the culmination of that, Patanjali says, is adeptship is the indivisible unity of mind and the spiritual will. So we know that is a possibility, because there are those who have been this way before, who have trod this path, and have offered this knowledge back to us. It is for us to take it up, soak it in, practice it, and thereby transmute it into wisdom. The object of the search, what is it we are truly searching for? The voice of the silence tells us, thou art thyself the object of thy search. So there is something within us that holds the key to all knowledge, all truth, all wisdom, because we are part of that unity of life. All of it is for us to take, but we must begin, as is said in the voice, to sift the false from the real. To do that, we need contrast, which is why we find ourselves on this plane of action. And we're told again in the voice, the seeds of wisdom cannot sprout and grow in airless space. To live and reap experience, the mind needs breath and depth and points to draw it towards the diamond soul. We must have experience. We must have direction. Seek not those points in Maya's realm, the realm of illusion, but soar beyond illusions, search the eternal and the changeless. And we are told to look within. The ocean of theosophy, which is what we are studying right now, tells us that this knowledge is so deep in its most divine aspect that it will take us lifetime after lifetime to reach it. Yet simplest in its sweetest and most easy to understand aspect, that it won't overwhelm the understanding of a child. So we have this synthesis of wisdom laid at our feet, and it is for us to pick it up and take it forward. Why do we do that? We have plenty of other things to do. Well, the ocean of theosophy says the aim for present man is his initiation into complete knowledge, and for the other kingdoms below him, that they may be raised up gradually from stage to stage to be in time initiated also. And we hear that in the three fundamentals, don't we? That the pivotal doctrine is man can turn and help his younger brothers in the lower kingdoms. So the soul is within. That is who and what we are. How do we access that? What is the path? Light on the path tells us, grow as the flower grows, unconsciously but eagerly anxious to open its soul to the air. So press forward to open your soul to the eternal. This does not happen in a vacuum. This does not happen in isolation. This happens in our everyday lives with every experience we go through with our brothers and sisters, because we are all truly one and connected. So we are told from Light on the Path, seek the way by retreating within. Then we're told, seek the way by advancing boldly without. And finally, seek it not by any one road. To each temperament, there is one road which seems the most desirable. But the way is not found by devotion alone, by religious contemplation alone, but by ardent progress, by self-sacrificing labor, by studious observation of life. So everything we do in every moment of our lives counts. It is part of this journey. It is part of this seeking of knowledge and the will to apply it in a better way. That is the whole purpose why we are here. And the voice of the silence tells us self-knowledge, which is what we're trying to achieve, is of loving deeds the child. So the way to achieve, the way to apply this knowledge that we're learning in the best possible means is to be loving, to consider your brother as yourself, to see in the eyes of the other the eternal which is within us. It is in every religion, it is in every system of thought and philosophy. And if we consider it the golden rule, we hear repeated in theosophy, with right knowledge, or at any rate with a confident conviction that our neighbors will no more work to hurt us than we would think of harming them, 2/3 of the world's evil would vanish into thin air. So we are the souls who put into motion this knowledge we have learned, this experience we have garnered, and through that, with reflection and observation, we begin to transmute these experiences into the gold of spiritual wisdom. And then we can look within and act as the Buddha that we all are. That's our goal. So your thoughts are invited this morning. Yes.
Well, our whole topic this morning really was dealing with that first sentence in the declaration about independent devotion. So, what you're saying is that the Savior or our Savior is not outside of us, but within us?
Absolutely. Theosophy says we don't need an outside Savior. Whether it's a God figure or we consider someone else can save us from our sins, quote unquote. Theosophy looks at that and says, you are the creator. In every moment that we spend alive and moving and thinking and acting, we are creating and setting into motion causes. Science tells us they must have their effect. So that is the law by which all universes work. They are subject to that law of cause and effect. So if I set this cause into motion and I am now reaping an effect from a previous cause, how could anyone or anything save me from it? And the powerful thought Theosophy offers, you created it, so you must be able to fix it.
But if we take the other half of independent devotion, devotion to what? We do require others. Just as a child would stay in their crib or just crawling around if they didn't see others to imitate, to walk, to talk. So we do require those who know more, and then we aspire to either be like them or surpass them. And that's the way we move through life. The problem basically is within our own culture, we too often accept authority and don't question it, don't bother to challenge ideas. So we follow along in a rut, something that others have dug. There's a wonderful quote from The Secret Doctrine. Gratification of curiosity is the end of knowledge for some men, was said by Bacon, as those who are familiar with it before him were right in hedging off wisdom from knowledge. Remember, knowledge dwells in heads replete with thoughts of other men, wisdom in minds attentive to their own. So we need the impulse that comes from those who know more, but then we have to do exactly what was said. Yes?
So you're referring to perfected beings or enlightened beings who keep these ideas alive, or this knowledge alive. If we're not to regard them as gods, how do we regard them?
We regard them as what they are, elder brothers. There is a clear distinction made that the term Mahatma means great soul. You and I are soul. The only difference is one of degree, of knowledge, of wisdom, of experience, of effort. So they are teachers to us, But the only way right now that we contact them is through the writings we have, the ones that we've been reading from, the ideas that they left for us. We have contact with other teachers right now, our fellow students, the circumstances in life. We should always be learning and correcting our own ignorance.
Agreed.
Yes.
I've been waiting for this class. You presented that ideas rule the world.
No, we think Plato presented that.
Yes. But you reiterated. That, so therefore, the ideas, so the world in which we live now is the result of ideas that we have held in the past.
Collectively.
But we're in this world now because we have some kind of association with those ideas. So coming to theosophy, if we want to change the world, what ideas must we have as a foundation to change that world or change ourselves?
First of all, we'd like to start with, before we answer that question or put it out to the audience, the idea that we are the creators, the preservers, and the destructors or regenerators of anything, any circumstances we find ourselves in. So we have the power to change the world. And it was started with what ideas do we hold to begin to use that power? Theosophy offers a fundamental principle that we are interconnected and interdependent reflections of a spiritual unity or a oneness or a divinity, a source that is immutable. It is not changed or affected by anything that may go on. It is eternal. It comes and goes in regular periods of manifestation for the benefit of soul. But it is that light within every speck of life that is the same in all of us. As was said, by degree, in some it is able to shine through more brightly due to the work that one has done. So that's one idea to begin with.
Yes?
We think that the question involves criteria. That means what do we use, or how do we begin to research the value of what we hear?
What is the criteria? What do we use to research? Well, a wonderful beginning is to literally sit down and write down the ideas that you hold. You may hold the idea that you are weak and miserable, that you are a sinner, that, you know, whatever you were raised with that's still there in the back of your mind, that you're dependent on someone to save you or the grace of someone to bless you. Then look at those ideas. Examine them in the light of other things that you are considering. What you want is to find a basis, as the Buddha said, that agrees with your own reason and intuition. Confucius, by three methods we may learn wisdom. First, by reflection, which is noblest, and we don't do too much of that. Second, by imitation, which is easiest. And third, by experience, which is bitterest. In other words, as reincarnating thinkers, if we don't do it the right way, we will do it the bitter way and experience the results of our own ignorant assumptions. So nobody has the power but us to change them whenever we're willing to do so.
And that experience is the only way we build discrimination, which is what is needed to discern the right way to go, the right motive, the proper choice. If we are deaf to our intuitive small voice, which we often say, yeah, okay, I know, but and we rationalize what we're going to do a lot of times. Sometimes we listen to it and make the right choice, but often we're too busy or we have another agenda. Well, the discrimination to begin to listen to that and hear ourselves echoing from the past, from past experience, comes from doing just what was described: reflection, investigation, learning, making charts of, here's that pattern I see again, how can I change it next time it arrives? So we need to be the investigators and the reflectors. Yes?
And we think that for most of us that have been coming and studying for a long time, those three fundamental principles are a good, shall we say, a ruler to judge, to help us learn to judge correctly.
Well, let's, as a group, I mean, those are just words unless we've actually used them. How do we apply the first fundamental to our daily lives? I mean, that's something so lofty and infinite. How do we use it in our daily lives? How would you apply that idea? Yes?
Be happy.
Be happy, because it is everywhere. Yes?
Well, we're all one in essence and potential. It's, some are shining brightly, others are learning through bitter experience, and they may be experiencing the dark, but that doesn't mean that they're not germinating seeds for the future, because we need to go through all experience. So,
all right, but we think an even simpler way is just to ask, if we're all one, truly one in essence, am I treating everyone equally? It's that simple. Am I? Now, what about the second fundamental? This is a universe of law. How do we use that in our daily lives? Yes?
Well, that everything that comes to me, there's something that I can learn from it. Not good or bad, but it's something that I can learn. There's something there for me. And let life be that, be part of the lessons of life.
The opportunity.
Opportunity.
Everything that comes to me is an opportunity. Or, in that simple way of stating it in the Gita, unto thee who findeth no fault. If you are the power that created what is coming to you, how can you complain about it? It's like a letter to Santa Claus. You sent that out, and now it's come back to you. You cannot complain. If you complain, you are using your own spiritual force to push away something that you created using that force. It's part of what keeps us nailed into our problems. We refuse to see they're ours. Yes?
We've got an idea that's always valuable, and that is the infant and the mother just before birth, the ninth month. The mother doesn't really give the birth. The mother
doesn't really give the birth.
When the child will be born, the child does. She feels him moving in her womb. He's the one. And then after that, he is assisted out of his mother. But he, the child, the infant, gives notice, I'm ready. So if we think about that and then apply it in our lives now, we are the ones, based on what we already have within us, the desire and the will to live, just like that infant before he causes his mother all that birth pain.
We are the infants, yes. All right, and the third fundamental, that all growth comes from within. What you see outward as growth, whether it's a season or a planet, whatever it is from the intelligence within expressing itself.
So how do we use that as a ruler in our daily lives? Yes?
We pivot. It's called the pivotal doctrine because we take the experience, we analyze it, we set a new chart, and then we can pivot. We can turn away from whatever the experiences that we have do not define us. We are much, much more than that.
Mm-hmm.
So we dismiss, we distill the lessons from the past, but we say, that's not me, really, in reality.
I am the chooser.
Yes, I am the chooser. So I can pivot and turn and evolve.
Because I have choice and I have will. We can also apply that to others. What we see in another is the temporary moment of their intelligence, or what seems like stupidity sometimes, expressing itself. But we do the very same thing. So we begin to look at others with a kind of charity, the realization that we've probably done worse than what we're seeing in front of us right now.
And we were thinking, evolution, this evolutionary process, this growth, is always assisted. There is always the force of nature, the force of the universe, willing and giving natural impulse to this process, wanting us to succeed in our evolution. So we were thinking, when we're looking at another who is in a moment of crisis for them, they're acting completely irrationally or whatever the situation is, pretend for a moment that this is a child who, were it a child, you would make allowances. You would say, how can I protect? You would say, what do I need to do to help this child in this moment? We all do that at times. We lose our sense of who and what we are and get lost, as was said, in the moment of a situation. So practically, in applying this knowledge, we can look at the other soul and say, they're lost for a moment. Let me step back and see if I can be of help, see if I can help diffuse whatever's going on, because we are part of whatever that karmic situation is that's unfolding right before us.
Yes?
You said that Confucius said that one of the ways was through reflection, that we need to reflect. What needs to reflect? What is it that is witnessing all this?
What's the only thing that we know about ourselves? It's the only lasting, permanent thing we really know about ourselves. It can't be our opinion. Changes, we hope. It can't be our body. That changes. It can't be our abilities. We can add to or detract. Yes?
I am.
I. Even just I. I. And you never mix it up with anyone else's I. No one gave it to you. No one said, here, you are I. You became aware of it on your own. And it is the witness to all you go through. What was your question?
Well, the question now is, that I
reflects.
In the personal I, or is there another I?
Ah, there is only one I, but it pivots. It can look up at what is higher, what is universal, or it can look down at what is personal, what is temporary. We're told that all temporary things, all compounds, are perishable. Our personal nature, our personal life, our personal ideas and feelings, they're all compounds. But I am eternal. I am not a compound. I am a spark of that divine essence. And it is that we have to reflect on. We have to stand like the center of a scale. It allows you to weigh things in either direction. It does not move. That's why it's able to produce this capacity to weigh. That's what we are in truth, that eternal, motionless, changeless center. So we have to take that position and reflect and review.
And we have made that personal side of our nature mighty powerful. It's got habits, it's got characteristics, it's got desires like you would not believe, because we fed it. So it is not going to give up easily. We must stand, as was said, firmly and take the position, I am the thinker. I am the eternal witness. When I act this way, here are the results. When I stay focused, the concentration and meditation that results gives me a completely different action, feeling, motive, influence in the world. So the other point is, once we recognize that we are the personal and the individual I, that we can look in either direction, we then must take responsibility for it. We can't unknow it after that. Mm-hmm. And that's what's really
it's like the infant taking birth as the example.
I think that was our comment from what we heard, that desire stands behind will, that karma, action, and reincarnation are inherent in everything. And there's that infant, a soul yearning to be born again, causing pain to the mother. But how does it know to move so that it can be assisted into being born? And it's our understanding that the seventh year is the beginning of knowing. And here we are, all different ages, and we are still that infant who has learned, we hope, some few ideas.
So well, you know, the philosophy tells us that we may all be of different ages, but we're all in the same condition. We're in the condition of returning to pay off debts and to gain in experience and wisdom. We're like an iceberg. We only see the tip. Below, there's thousands and thousands of incarnations and probably assimilated experiences. But we're here for our faults. We're here to fix things. And as we do, some of that wisdom that we have assimilated becomes available to us. It happened to us in this life already. We came here.
And we were thinking the object then is really to blend the higher and the lower. And Patanjali tells us, with the attainment of perfect discriminative knowledge, the soul sees body as body and soul as soul, and thus transcends the confusions of incarnation by reaping the benefits of learning which only incarnation makes possible. This is the field where we can learn that we can act in either way, and that we can begin to blend the mind with the heart, as it were, or transmute the selfish into something better. That's our whole journey.
Yes?
I really like most of this, and that's why I'm here today. It's my pursuit and my search. But if I may, sometimes it strikes me as a little superhuman, this idea. I'm curious about how you can reconcile the eternal I with the concept that we are all one, and yet at the same time with your analogy to the scales about how we balance at all times, and sort of putting that all together with sort of human emotions and how important they are to us. And if we are going to be at the same time the I and also a universal whole with our brothers and sisters, how do you do that and still be human with your emotions and so forth? Say you want to be an artist or something like that. That's not going off by yourself and painting or sculpting or playing an instrument to learn is not immediately helpful to your community if you want to build a house, you know.
To take a couple of your comments, one is that the philosophy says that an artist who is truly an artist at that moment, whether a composer or a painter, whatever, at that moment, they are not personal or emotional. They are completely absorbed in being the instrument for what is consuming them, which is a higher idea, a higher ideal. At moments like that, and at moments in meditation, we do realize we are one. But the challenge is, we are one, but we are like all the rays of sunlight. We are all in different capacities. And the task is to bring that sense of unity here and now, and to use it for the benefit of all life around us. Human emotions are one thing. We're not really human. If we were more human, we couldn't do the things we do to each other. It's the true, unifying spiritual emotions that we should have, which is compassion, altruism, the golden rule, as was mentioned. So it's to bring that realization of true unity into the particulars of the day.
And part of the question was to reconcile the I with that of each other. If we look for what is universal in all of us, it takes us back to that oneness. We all have the power to think. We all have the power to perceive. We all have the power of the senses in differing degrees. We all have the power to feel altruism, to feel love, to feel the impulse of nature to progress, to do better. All of those, we all have the power of will. All of those are spiritual powers that come from the source of divinity. There is no other way to express it. We had something here, but we lost it. But anyway, if we take what appears to be differentiated and take it back to its source, what is exactly the same in each one of us, it must come from one unified source and has been reflected or differentiated or emanated out, so that Theosophy says we are all sparks of that one deific source.
Yes.
It was said in the previous comment, and rightfully so, that it seems a little superhuman to consider, you know, the I in me is the I of all. But theosophically speaking, perhaps that's what we mean by, it's not so much superhuman, but it's perfectly human. Mm-hmm. And there are those of our elder brothers who have perfected themselves, who are the perfect expression of universal mind, who work in ways to share those ideas, to set the example, to be of service to mankind. And the perfect expression of that affects posterity for thousands of years by the example of one person. Mm-hmm. And all we're saying then is, if he can do it, and he's human, the only difference is that we are not perfectly human yet.
Exactly.
And it's a matter of time and effort before we become. But the more effort we put into it, the more we can see that we are a human family rather than just a bunch of individuals.
Yes, but that is in that here and now. We are essentially not human. We are spiritual beings using the highest form on the planet in order to elevate the life below us and to gain an experience and wisdom and knowledge. We are not human. We are spiritual, divine beings.
Using human forms.
Using human forms, but if we really could bring that through in our everyday life, we would have a very different kind of humanity, like a Buddha. But a Buddha is a reflection of that true spiritual nature into the human as much as it can be based on the limitation of that form. Yes?
One of the ways that I heard that expressed was that humanity is the bridge between animal and God. So it's not so much that I am, this is the travel, this is the road that I'm traveling, and this is the part of the road that I am on at this particular time. I am between animal and God, somewhere in the beginning of humanity.
That's an interesting way to put it, but we think a clearer way is the theosophical one that says that spirit and matter are everything. It is two sides of a coin or a hand. Everything is spirit matter, and they can only meet each other, because obviously the two sides of your hand cannot know each other. They can only meet each other in the incarnation of a thinker. We can stand in that center and weigh and look and see both sides, spirit, matter. Spirit and matter can't do that. Only the thinker can. So we are spiritual beings using a material form that is a bridge, but it only works because we have will and choice, because we have that power of spirit to think and will and choose.
And we are self-conscious. We know where the lower kingdoms are conscious, but not aware of self yet. So that makes the difference in using free will and choice.
Yes.
Well, it's rather interesting that we see this power, this spirit, come alive in mostly all religions. In Shabbat dinner, in Islam and Sufism, there's when people gather in my name, I will be there. I think it's in the Gita that there's a presence that people evoke when they gather together as spiritual beings.
Mm-hmm.
And that the only thing that we've seen through history and probably have brought us here is that it's only for a select few that we gather in the name of either you're Jewish or you're Islamic or whatever. So everything is separate. So all great wars and battles have grown up around the division of separateness.
Well, according to Theosophy, all the great wars and battles are the result of the great war and battle within ourselves that we're refusing to fight. Every group of people has a core belief in the divinity of life, in the spirituality of life. And yes, for the most part, they restrict it to their group and their tribe, their way of thinking. That's another thing that we have to do, is review for ourselves. What are my prejudices? What do I think about others? How do I feel about various religions? What are my questions? What are the answers I have got to find out for myself? Only the individual can know that and can make that search. The benefit with Theosophy is it lays it out for us. You have to bring your opinions and ideas to the philosophy in order to examine them, to see if they will hold up, or if you're going to reach in and literally reach for higher ideas.
And a group is chosen as long as the selves within it decide to continue to remain. Because if free will and choice is our birthright, being self-conscious beings, we decide what we believe and what we hold to. And when we understand that that is not the truth, then we search on.
Yes?
Well, it was interesting, all the quotes that were read in the first speaker,
I mean, if we didn't know that they were from other philosophies, we would have thought that they were from theosophy. And it, I mean, it's the, somebody had said the sin of separateness. So we think that that is part of where all the dissension comes in, because we hear those quotes and we know that if we take back all the philosophies to their essence, it's theosophy. And it's the trappings and the dissension and that sin of separateness that leads us to all the friction that there is out there today. But it was interesting. We think it's, we think a tide might be shifting, and we would hope that it is. It just seems lately that people are using some of the technology today to join together as one mind to help change what some of the things that are going on today.
Absolutely. We have a very short time left. We just wanted to mention there's a lovely poem on knowledge by Khalil Gibran, a Lebanese poet. If you'd like it, there's copies on the desk for you. But we would like to close with a quote from The Voice of the Silence. Have patience, candidate, as one who fears no failure courts no success. Fix thy soul's gaze upon the star whose ray thou art, the flaming star that shines within the lightless depths of ever-being, the boundless fields of the unknown. Have perseverance as one who doth forevermore endure. Thy shadows live and vanish. That which in thee shall live forever, that which in thee knows, for it is knowledge, is not a fleeting life. It is the man that was, that is, and will be, for whom the hour shall never strike. Meeting adjourned.